trees. Will stood where he was, looking at the rider, his heart thumping so fiercely that it was hard to breathe. "It was unwise to leave the road, Will Stanton," said the man in the cloak, and his eyes blazed like blue stars. The black horse edged forward, forward. Will shrank back against the side of the flimsy hut, staring into the eyes, and then, with a great effort, he made his slow arm pull aside his jacket so that the iron circle on his belt showed clear. He gripped the belt at its side. The coldness of the sign was so intense that he could feel the force from it like the radiation of a fierce burning heat. And the rider paused, and his eyes flickered.
"So you have one of them already?"
He hunched his shoulders strangely, and the horse tossed its head. Both seemed to be gaining strength, to be growing taller.
"One will not help you, not alone, not yet," said the rider, and he grew and grew, looming against the white world, while his stallion neighed triumphantly, rearing up, its forefeet lashing the air so that Will could only press himself helpless against the wall.
Horse and rider towered over him like a dark cloud, blotting out both snow and sun. And then, dimly, he heard new sounds, and the rearing black shapes seemed to fall to one side, swept away by a blazing golden light, brilliant with fierce patterns of white-hot circles, suns, stars. Will blinked, and saw suddenly that it was the white mare from the smithy, rearing over him in turn. He grabbed frantically at the waving mane, and just as before he found himself jerked up onto the broad back, bent low over the mare's neck, clutching for his life. The great white horse let out a shrieking cry and leapt for the track through the trees, passing the shapeless black cloud that hung motionless in the clearing like smoke, passing everything in a rising gallop, until they came at last to the road, Huntercombe Lane, the road through Hunter's Combe. The movement of the great horse changed to a slow-rising, powerful lope, and Will heard the beating of his own heart in his ears as the world flashed by in a white blur. Then all at once, greyness came around them, and the sun was blacked out. The wind wrenched into Will's collar and sleeves and boot-tops, ripping at his hair. Great clouds rushed towards them out of the north, closing in, huge grey-black thunderheads. The sky rumbled and growled. One white misted gap remained, with a faint hint of blue behind it still, but it too was closing, closing. The white horse leapt at it desperately. Over his shoulder, Will saw swooping towards them a darker shape even than the giant clouds, the rider, towering immense, his eyes two dreadful points of blue-white fire. Lightning flashed, thunder split the sky, and the mare leapt at the crashing clouds as the last gap closed. And they were safe. The sky was blue before and above them, the sun blazing, warming Will's skin. He saw that they had left his Thames Valley behind. Now they were among the curving slopes of the Chiltern Hills, capped with great trees, beech and oak and ash. And running like threads through the snow along the lines of the hills were the hedges that were the marks of ancient fields, very ancient, as Will had always known, more ancient than anything in his world except the hills themselves and the trees. Then on one white hill, he saw a different mark. The shape was cut through snow and turf into the chalk beneath the soil. It would have been hard to make out if it had not been familiar, but Will knew it. The mark was a circle, quartered by a cross. Then his hands were jerked away from their tight clutch on the thick mane, and the white mare gave a long, shrill, whinnying cry that was loud in his ears, and then, strangely, died away into a far distance. And Will was falling, falling. Yet he knew no shock of a fall, but knew only that he was lying face down on cold snow. He stumbled to his feet, shaking himself. The white horse was gone. The sky was clear, and the sunshine warm on the back of his neck. He stood on a snow-mounded hill, with a copse of tall trees capping it far beyond, and two tiny black birds drifting to and fro above the trees. And before him, standing alone and tall on the white slope, leading to nowhere, were two great carved wooden doors. The Sign Seeker. Will thrust his cold hands into his pockets and stood staring up at the carved panels of the two closed doors towering before him. They told him nothing. He could find no meaning in the zigzag symbols repeated over and over in endless variation on every panel. The wood of the doors was like no wood he had ever seen. It was cracked and pitted and yet polished by age, so that you could scarcely tell it was wood at all except by a rounding here and there, where someone had not quite been able to avoid leaving the trace of a knothole. If it had not been for signs like those, Will would have taken the doors to be stone. His eyes slid beyond their outline as he looked, and he saw that all around them was a quivering of things, a movement like the shaking of the air over a bonfire or over a paved road baked by a summer sun. Yet there was no difference in heat to explain it here. There were no handles on the doors. Will stretched his arms forward, with the palm of each hand flat against the wood, and he pushed. As the doors swung open beneath his hands, he thought that he caught a phrase of the fleeting bell-like music again. But then it was gone into the misty gap between memory and imagining. And he was through the doorway, and without a murmur of sound, the two huge doors swung shut behind him, and the light and the day and the world changed so that he forgot utterly what they had been. He stood now in a great hall. There was no sunlight here. Indeed, there were no real windows in the lofty stone walls, but only a series of thin slits. Between these, on both sides, hung a series of tapestries so strange and beautiful that they seemed to glow in the half-light. Will was dazzled by the brilliant animals and flowers and birds, woven or embroidered there in rich colours like sunlit stained glass. Images leapt at him. He saw a silver unicorn, a field of red roses, a glowing golden sun. Above his head, the high vaulted beams of the roof arched up into shadow. Other shadows masked the far end of the room. He moved dreamily a few paces forward, his feet making no sound on the sheepskin rugs that covered the stone floor, and he peered ahead. All at once sparks leapt and fire flared in the darkness, lighting up an enormous fireplace in the far wall, and he saw doors and high-backed chairs and a heavy carved table. On either side of the fireplace, two figures stood waiting for him, an old lady leaning on a stick and a tall man.
"Welcome, Will,"
the old lady said in a voice that was soft and gentle, yet rang through the vaulted hall like a treble bell. She put out one thin hand towards him, and the firelight glinted on a huge ring that rose round as a marble above her finger. She was very small, fragile as a bird, and though she was upright and alert, Will, looking at her, had an impression of immense age. He could not see her face. He paused where he stood, and unconsciously his hand crept to his belt. Then the tall figure on the other side of the fireplace moved, bent, and lighted a long taper at the fire, and coming forward to the table began putting the taper to a ring of tall candles there. Light from the smoking yellow flame played on his face. Will saw a strong, bony head, with deep-set eyes and an arched nose fierce as a hawk's beak, a sweep of wiry white hair springing back from the high forehead, bristling brows and a jutting chin. And though he did not know why, as he stared at the fierce secret lines of that face, the world he had inhabited since he was born seemed to whirl and break and come down again in a pattern that was not the same as before. Straightening, the tall man looked at him, across the circle of lighted candles that stood on the table in a frame like the rim of a flat resting wheel. He smiled slightly, the grim mouth slanting up at its edges, and a sudden fan of lines wrinkling each side of the deep-set eyes. He blew out the burning taper with a quick breath.
"Come in, Will Stanton,"
he said, and the deep voice too seemed to leap in Will's memory.
"Come and learn.
and bring that candle with you." Puzzled, Will glanced around him. Close to his right hand, he found a black wrought-iron stand as tall as himself, rising to 3 points. 2 of the points were tipped by a 5-pointed iron star, and the third by a candlestick holding a thick white candle. He lifted out the candle, which was heavy enough to need both hands, and crossed the hall to the 2 figures waiting at the other end. Blinking through the light, he saw as he approached them that the circle of candles on the table was not a complete circle after all. One holder in the ring was empty. He leaned across the table, gripping the hard, smooth sides of the candle, lighted it from one of the others, and fitted it carefully into the empty socket. It was identical with the rest. They were very strange candles, uneven in width, but cold and hard as white marble. They burned with a long, bright flame and no smoke, and smelled faintly resinous, like pine trees. It was only as he leaned back to stand upright that Will noticed the 2 crossed arms of iron inside the candlestick ring. Here again, as everywhere, was the sign, the cross within the circle, the quartered sphere. There were other sockets for candles within the frame, he saw now, 2 along each arm of the cross, and 1 at the central point where they met. But these were still empty. The old lady relaxed and sat down in the high-backed chair beside the hearth.
"Very good,"
she said comfortably in that same musical voice.
"Thank you, Will."
She smiled, her face folding into a cobweb of wrinkles, and Will grinned wholeheartedly back. He had no idea why he was suddenly so happy. It seemed too natural to be questioned. He sat down on a stool which was clearly waiting for him in front of the fire between the 2 chairs.
"The doors," he said. "The great doors I came through. How do they just stand there on their own?" "The doors?" the lady said.
Something in her voice made Will look back over his shoulder at the far wall from which he had just come, the wall with the 2 high doors and the holder from which he had taken the candle. He stared. There was something wrong. The great wooden doors had vanished. The grey wall stretched blank, its massive square stones quite featureless except for 1 round golden shield, alone, hanging high up and glinting dully in the light from the fire. The tall man laughed softly.
"Nothing is what it seems, boy. Expect nothing, and fear nothing. Here or anywhere, there's your first lesson. And here's your first exercise. We have here before us Will Stanton. Tell us what has been happening to him this last day or two."
Will looked into the urgent flames, warm and welcome on his face in the chill room. It took much effort to wrench his mind back to the moment when he and James had left home for Dawson's farm to collect hay. Hay, the previous afternoon. He thought, bemused, about everything that stood between that moment and his present self. After a while, he said,
"The sign, the circle with the cross. Yesterday, Mr. Dawson gave me the sign. Then the walker came after me, or tried to, and afterwards they... whoever they are, they tried to get me."
He swallowed, cold at the memory of his night's fear.
"To get the sign. They want it. That's what everything is about. That's what today is about, too, even though it's so much more complicated, because now isn't now. It's some other time. I don't know when. With everything like a dream... but real. They're still after it. I don't know who they are, except for the rider and the walker. I don't know you, either. Only I know you are against them. You and Mr. Dawson and John Wayland Smith." He stopped.
"Go on," said the deep voice.
"Wayland," Will said, perplexed. "That's an odd name. That's not part of John's name. What made me say that?"
"Minds hold more than they know," the tall man said, "particularly yours. And what else have you to say?"
"I don't know," Will said.
He looked down and ran a finger along the edge of his stool. It was carved in gentle, regular waves, like a peaceful sea.
"Well, Yes, I do. Two things. One is that there's something funny about the walker. I don't really think he's one of them, because he was scared stiff of the rider when he saw him and ran away.
Any other thing? The big man said. Somewhere in the shadows of the great room, a clock struck with a deep note like a muffled bell. A single note. A half hour.
The rider, Will said. When the rider saw the sign, he said, "So you have one of them already?" He didn't know I had it, but he had come after me, chasing me. Why? Yes, said the old lady.
She was looking at him rather sadly.
He was chasing you. I'm afraid the guess that is in your mind is right, Will. It isn't the sign they want most of all. It's you.
The big man stood up and crossed behind Will so that he stood with one hand on the back of the old lady's chair and the other in the pocket of the dark, high-necked jacket he wore. "Look at me, Will," he said. Light from the burning ring of candles on the table glinted on his springing white hair and put his strange, shadowed eyes into even deeper shadows, pools of darkness in the bony face. "My name is Merriman Lyon," he said. "I greet you, Will Stanton. We have been waiting for you for a long time."
"I know you," Will said. "I mean, you look... I felt... Don't I know you?"
"In a sense," Merriman said, "you and I are, shall we say, similar. We were born with the same gift and for the same high purpose. And you are in this place at this moment, Will, to begin to understand what that purpose is. But first, you must be taught about the gift."
Everything seemed to be running too far, too fast. "I don't understand," Will said, looking at the strong, intent face in alarm. "I haven't any gift. Really, I haven't. I mean, there's nothing special about me."
He looked from one to the other of them, figures alternately lit and shadowed by the dancing flames of candles and fire, and he began to feel a rising fear, a sense of being trapped. He said,
"It's just the things that have been happening to me, that's all." "Think back and remember some of those things," the old lady said. "Today is your birthday. Midwinter Day, your 11th Midwinter's Day. Think back to yesterday, your 10th Midwinter's Eve, before you first saw the sign. Was there nothing special at all then? Nothing new?"
Will thought.
"The animals were scared of me," he said reluctantly. "And the birds, perhaps. But it didn't seem to mean anything at the time."
"And if you had a radio or a television set switched on in the house," Merriman said, "it behaved oddly whenever you went near it."
Will stared at him.
"The radio did keep making noises. How did you know that? I thought it was sunspots or something."
Merriman smiled.
"In a way, in a way."
Then he was somber again.
"Listen now. The gift I speak of, it is a power that I will show you. It is the power of the old ones, who are as old as this land and older even than that. You were born to inherit it, Will, when you came to the end of your 10th year. On the night before your birthday it was beginning to wake, and now, on the day of your birth, it is free, flowering, fully grown. But it is still confused and unchanneled because you are not in proper control of it yet. You must be trained to handle it before it can fall into its true pattern and accomplish the quest for which you are here. Don't look so prickly, boy. Stand up. I'll show you what it can do."
Will stood up, and the old lady smiled encouragingly at him. He said to her suddenly,
"Who are you?"
"The lady," Merriman began.
"The lady is very old," she said in her clear, young voice, "and has in her time had many, many names. Perhaps it would be best for now, Will, if you were to go on thinking of me as the old lady." Yes, ma'am,
Will said. And at the sound of her voice, his happiness came flooding back, the rising alarm dropped away, and he stood up erect and eager, peering into the shadow behind her chair where Merriman had moved a few paces back. He could see the glint of white hair on the tall figure, but no more. Merriman's deep voice came out of the shadow.
Stand still. Look at whatever you like, but not hard. Concentrate on nothing. Let your mind wander. Pretend you are in a boring class at school.
Will laughed and stood there relaxed, tilting his head back. He squinted up, idly trying to distinguish between the dark, crisscrossing beams in the high roof and the black lines that were their shadows. Merriman said casually,
I'm putting a picture into your mind. Tell me what you see.
The image formed itself in Will's mind as naturally as if he had decided to paint an imaginary landscape and were making up the look of it before putting it on paper. He said, describing the details as they came to him,
There's a grassy hillside over the sea, like a sort of gentle cliff. Lots of blue sky, and the sea a darker blue underneath. A long way down, right down there where the sea meets the land, there's a strip of sand, lovely glowing golden sand. And inland from the grassy headland, you can't really see it from here except out of the corner of your eye, hills, misty hills. They're a sort of soft purple, and their edges dissolve into a blue mist, the way the colours in a painting dissolve into one another if you keep it wet. And he came out of his half-trance of seeing and looked hard at Merriman, peering into the shadow with inquisitive interest. And it's a sad picture. You miss it. You're homesick for wherever it is. Where is it?
Enough, Merriman said hastily,
but he sounded pleased.
You do well. Now it is your turn. Give me a picture, Will. Just choose some ordinary scene, anything, and think of the way it looks, as if you were standing looking at it.
Will thought of the first image that came into his head. It was one which he realized now had been worrying away at the back of his thoughts all this while. The picture of the two great doors, isolated on the snowy hillside, with all their intricate carving and the strange blue at their edges. Merriman said at once,
Not the doors, nothing so close. Somewhere from your life before this winter came.
For a second, Will stared at him, disconcerted. Then he swallowed hard, closed his eyes, and thought of the jeweler's shop his father ran in the little town of Eton. Merriman said slowly,
The door handle is of the lever kind, like a round bar to be pushed downward perhaps 10 degrees on opening. A small hanging bell rings as the door moves. You step down a few inches to reach the floor, and the jolt of the drop is startling without being dangerous. There are glass showcases all round the walls and beneath the glass counter. Of course, this must be your father's shop. There's some beautiful things inside it. A grandfather clock, very old, in the back corner with a painted face and a deep, slow tick. A turquoise necklet in the central showcase, with a setting of silver serpents. Zuni work, I think, a very long way from home. An emerald pendant like a great green tear. A small, enchanting model of a Crusader castle in gold. Perhaps a salt cellar that you have loved, I think, since you were a small boy. And that man behind the counter, short and content and gentle, must be your father, Roger Stanton. Interesting to see him clearly at last, free of the mist. He has a jeweler's glass in his eye, and he is looking at a ring. An old gold ring with 9 tiny stones set in 3 rows, 3 diamond chips in the centre and 3 rubies at either side, and some curious runic lines edging those that I think I must look at more closely one day soon.
You even got the ring, Will said, fascinated. That's Mother's ring. Dad was looking at it last time I was in the shop. She thought one of the stones was loose, but he said it was an optical illusion. However do you do it?
Do what?
There was an ominous softness in the deep voice.
Well, that. Put a picture in my head, and then see the one I had there myself. Telepathy, isn't it called? It's tremendous.
But an uneasiness was beginning in his mind.
Very well, Merriman said patiently. I will show you in another way. There is a circle of candle flames beside you there on the table, Will Stanton. Now, do you know of any possible way of putting out one of those flames other than blowing it out or quenching it with water or snuffer or hand?
No.
No, there is none. But now I tell you that you, because you are who you are, can do that simply by wishing it. For the gift that you have, this is a very small task indeed. If in your mind you choose one of those flames and think of it without even looking, think of it and tell it to go out, then that flame will go out. And is that a possible thing for any normal boy to do?
No,
Will said unhappily.
Do it, Merriman said. Now.
There was a sudden thick silence in the room like velvet. Will could feel them both watching him. He thought desperately,
I'll get out of it. I'll think of a flame, but it won't be one of those. It'll be something much bigger, something that couldn't be put out except by some tremendous, impossible magic even Merriman doesn't know.
He looked across the room at the light and shadow dancing side by side across the rich tapestries on the stone walls, and he thought hard, in furious concentration, of the image of the blazing log fire in the huge fireplace behind him. He felt the warmth of it on the back of his neck, and thought of the glowing orange heart of the big pile of logs, and the leaping yellow tongues of flame.
Go out, fire,
he said to it in his mind, feeling suddenly safe and free from the dangers of power, because, of course, no fire as big as that could possibly go out without a real reason.
Stop burning, fire. Go out.
And the fire went out. All at once the room was chill and darker. The ring of candle flames on the table burned on in a small cold pool of their own light only. Will spun round, staring in consternation at the hearth. There was no hint of smoke or water or any way in which the fire could possibly have died. But dead it was, cold and black, without a spark. He moved towards it slowly. Merriman and the old lady said no word and did not stir. Will bent and touched the blackened logs in the hearth, and they were cold as stone, yet furred with a layer of new ash that fell away under his fingers into a white dust. He stood up, rubbing his hand slowly up and down his trouser leg, and looked helplessly at Merriman. The man's deep eyes burned like black candle flames, but there was compassion in them, and as Will glanced nervously across at the old lady, he saw a kind of tenderness in her face too. She said gently,
"It's a little cold, Will."
For a timeless interval that was no more than the flicker of a nerve, Will felt a screaming flash of panic, a memory of the fear he had felt in the dark nightmare of the snowstorm. And then it was gone, and in the peace of its vanishing he felt somehow stronger, taller, more relaxed. He knew that in some way he had accepted the power, whatever it was, that he had been resisting, and he knew what he must do. Taking a deep breath, he squared his shoulders and stood straight and firm there in the great hall. He smiled at the old lady, then looked past her, at nothing, and concentrated on the image of the fire.
"Come back, fire," he said in his mind. "Burn again."
And the light was dancing over the tapestried walls once more, and the warmth of the flames was back on his neck, and the fire burned.
"Thank you,"
the old lady said.
"Well done,"
said Merriman softly, and Will knew that he was not speaking merely of the extinguishing and relighting of a fire.
"It is a burden," Merriman said. "Make no mistake about that. Any great gift of power or talent is a burden, and this more than any, and you will often long to be free of it. But there is nothing to be done.
If you were born with the gift, then you must serve it, and nothing in this world or out of it may stand in the way of that service. Because that is why you were born, and that is the law. And it is just as well, young Will, that you have only a glimmering of an idea of the gift that is in you, for until the first ordeals of learning are over, you will be in great danger. And the less you know of the meaning of your power, the better able it will be to protect you, as it has done for the last 10 years. He gazed at the fire for a moment, frowning. I will tell you only this, that you are one of the old ones, the first to have been born for 500 years, and the last. And like all such, you are bound by nature to devote yourself to the long conflict between the light and the dark. Your birth, Will, completed a circle that has been growing for 4,000 years in every oldest part of this land. The circle of the old ones. Now that you have come into your power, your task is to make that circle indestructible. It is your quest to find and to guard the 6 great signs of the light, made over the centuries by the old ones, to be joined in power only when the circle is complete. The first sign hangs on your belt already, but to find the rest will not be easy. You are the sign-seeker, Will Stanton. That is your destiny, your first quest. If you can accomplish that, you will have brought to life one of the 3 great forces that the old ones must turn soon towards vanquishing the powers of the dark, which are reaching out now steadily and stealthily over all this world. The rhythms of his voice, which had been rising and falling in an increasingly formal pattern, changed subtly into a kind of chanted battle cry. A call, Will thought suddenly, with a chill tightening his skin, to things beyond the great hall and beyond the time of the calling. For the dark is rising. The walker is abroad. The rider is riding. They have woken. The dark is rising. And the last of the circle is come to claim his own, and the circles must now all be joined. The white horse must go to the hunter, and the river take the valley. There must be fire on the mountain, fire under the stone, fire over the sea, fire to burn away the dark. For the dark is rising. He stood there tall as a tree in the shadowed room, his deep voice ringing out in an echo, and Will could not take his eyes from him. The dark is rising. That was exactly what he had felt last night. That was what he was beginning to feel again now, a shadowy awareness of evil pricking at his fingertips and the top of his spine. But for the life of him, he could not utter a word. Merriman said in a sing-song tone that came strangely from his awesome figure, as if he were a child reciting, when the dark comes rising, 6 shall turn it back. 3 from the circle, 3 from the track. Wood, bronze, iron, water, fire, stone. 5 will return, and 1 go alone. Then he swept forward out of the shadow, past the old lady, still and bright-eyed in her high-backed chair. With one hand he raised one of the thick white candles out of the burning ring, and with the other swung Will towards the towering side wall. Look well for each moment, Will, he said. The old ones will show something of themselves and remind the deepest part of you. For one moment, look at each. And with Will beside him, he strode long-legged round the hall, holding the candle aloft again and again beside each of the hanging tapestries on the walls. Each time, as if he had commanded it, one bright image shone for an instant out of each glowing embroidered square, as bright and deep as a sunlit picture seen through a window frame. And Will saw. He saw a may tree, white with blossom, growing from the thatched roof of a house. He saw 4 great grey standing stones on a green headland over the sea. He saw the empty-eyed grinning white skull of a horse, with a single stubby broken horn in the bony forehead, and red ribbons wreathing the long jaws. He saw lightning striking a huge beech tree, and out of the flash, a great fire burning on a bare hillside against a black sky. He saw the face of a boy not much older than himself staring curiously into his own, a dark face beneath light-streaked dark hair, with strange cat-like eyes, the pupils light-bordered but almost yellow within. He saw a broad river in flood, and beside it a wizened old man perched on an enormous horse. As Merriman whirled him inexorably from one picture to the next, he saw suddenly, with a flash of terror, the brightest image of all. A masked man, with a human face, the head of a stag, the eyes of an owl, the ears of a wolf, and the body of a horse. The figure leapt, tugging at some lost memory deep within his mind.
"Remember them," Merriman said. "They will be a strength."
Will nodded, then stiffened. All at once he heard noises growing outside the hall, and knew with a dreadful shock of certainty why it was that he had felt such uneasiness a short time before. While the old lady sat motionless in her chair, and he and Merriman stood again beside the hearth, the great hall was filled suddenly with a hideous mixture of moaning and mumbling and strident wailing, like the caged voices of an evil zoo. It was a sound more purely nasty than any he had ever heard. The hair prickled at the back of Will's neck, and then suddenly there was silence. A log fell rustling in the fire. Will heard the blood beating in his veins. And into the silence a new sound came from somewhere outside, beyond the far wall. The heartbroken, beseeching whine of a forsaken dog calling in panic for help and friendliness. It sounded exactly as Rack and Cy, their own dogs, had sounded when they were puppies crying for comfort in the dark. Will felt himself dissolve into sympathy, and he turned instinctively towards the sound.
"Oh, where is it? Poor thing."
As he looked at the blank stone of the far wall, he saw a door take shape in it. It was not a door like the huge vanished pair by which he had entered, but far smaller, an odd, pinched little door looking totally out of place. But he knew he could open it to help the imploring dog. The animal whined again in more acute misery than before, louder, more pleading, in a desperate half-howl. Will swung impulsively forward to run to the door, then was frozen in mid-step by Merriman's voice. It was soft, but cold as winter stone.
"Wait. If you saw the shape of the poor, sad dog, you would be greatly surprised. And it will be the last thing you would ever see."
Incredulous, Will stood and waited. The whining died away in a last long howl. There was silence for a moment. Then all at once, he heard his mother's voice from behind the door.
"Will! Will! Come and help me! Will!"
It was unmistakably her voice, but filled with an unfamiliar emotion. There was in it a note of half-controlled panic that horrified him. It came again.
"Will, I need you. Where are you, Will? Oh, please, Will, come and help me."
And then an unhappy break at the end, like a sob. Will could not bear it. He lurched forward and ran towards the door. Merriman's voice came after him like a whiplash. "Stop!"
"But I must go. Can't you hear her?" Will shouted angrily. "They've got my mother. I've got to help."
"Don't open that door."
There was a hint of desperation in the deep voice that told Will, through instinct, that in the last resort, Merriman was powerless to stop him.
"That is not your mother, Will,"
the old lady said clearly.
"Please, Will,"
his mother's voice begged.
"I'm coming."
Will reached out to the door's heavy latch, but in his haste he stumbled, and knocked against the great head-high candlestick so that his arm was jarred against his side. There was a sudden searing pain in his forearm, and he cried out and dropped to the floor, staring at the inside of his wrist, where the sign of the quartered circle was burned agonizingly red into his skin. Once more the iron symbol on his belt had caught him with its ferocious bite of cold. It burned this time with a cold like white heat, in a furious, flaring warning against the presence of evil. The presence that Will had felt but forgotten. Merriman and the old lady still had not moved. Will stumbled to his feet and listened, while outside the door his mother's voice wept, then grew angry and threatened, then softened again and coaxed and cajoled, then finally ceased, dying away in a sob that tore at him, even though his mind and senses told him it was not real. And the door faded with it, melting like mist, until the grey stone wall was solid and unbroken as before. Outside, the dreadful, inhuman chorus of moaning and wailing began again. The old lady rose to her feet then and came across the hall, her long green dress rustling gently at every step. She took Will's hurt forearm in both her hands and put her cool right palm over it. Then she released him. The pain in Will's arm was gone, and where the red burn had been, he saw now the shiny, hairless skin that grows in when a burn has been long healed. But the shape of the scar was clear, and he knew he would bear it to the end of his life. It was like a brand. The nightmare sounds beyond the wall rose and fell in uneven waves.
"I'm sorry," Will said miserably.
"We are besieged, as you see," Merriman said, coming forward to join them. "They hope to gain a hold over you while you are not yet grown into your full power. And this is only the beginning of the peril, Will. Through all this midwinter season their power will be waxing very strong, with the old magic able to keep it at a distance only on Christmas Eve. And even past Christmas it will grow, not losing its high force until the 12th day, the 12th night, which once was Christmas Day. And once, before that, long ago, was the high winter festival of our old year."
"What will happen?"
Will said.
"We must think only of the things that we must do," the old lady said. "The first is to free you from the circle of dark power that is drawn now round this room."
Merriman said, listening intently,
"Be on your guard against anything. They have failed with one emotion. They will try to trap you through another next."
"But it must not be fear," she said. "Remember that, Will. You will be frightened often, but never fear them. The powers of the dark can do many things, but they cannot destroy. They cannot kill those of the light, not unless they gain a final dominion over the whole earth. And it is the task of the old ones, your task and ours, to prevent that. So do not let them put you into fear or despair."
She went on, saying more, but her voice was drowned like a rock submerged in a high tide wave, as the horrible chorus that whined and keened outside the walls rose louder, louder, faster and angrier, into a cacophony of screeches and unearthly laughter, shrieks of terror and cackles of mirth, howlings and roars. As Will listened, his skin crept and grew damp. As if in a dream, he heard Merriman's deep voice ring out through the dreadful noise, calling him. He could not have moved if the old lady had not taken his hand, drawing him across the room, back towards the table and the hearth, the only cave of light in the dark hall. Merriman spoke close to his ear, swift and urgent.
"Stand by the circle of light. Stand with your back to the table and take our hands. It is a joining they cannot break."
Will stood there, his arms spread wide. As out of sight beside him, each of them took one of his hands. The light of the fire in the hearth died, and he became aware that behind him the flames of the candle circle on the table had grown tall, gigantic, so high that when he tilted back his head he could see them rising far over him in a white pillar of light. There was no heat from this great tree of flame, and though it glowed with great brilliance, it cast no light beyond the table. Will could not see the rest of the hall, not the walls, nor the pictures, nor any door. He could see nothing but blackness, the vast black emptiness of the awful looming night. This was the dark, rising to swallow Will Stanton before he could grow strong enough to do it harm. In the light from the strange candle, Will held fast to the old lady's frail fingers and Merriman's wood-hard fist. The shrieking of the dark grew to an intolerable peak, a high, triumphant whinnying, and Will knew without sight that before him in the darkness, the great black stallion was rearing up as it had done outside the hut in the woods, with the rider there to strike him down if the new-shod hooves did not do their work. And no white mare this time could spring from the sky to his rescue. He heard Merriman shout, "The tree of flame, Will! Strike out with the flame! As you spoke to the fire, speak to the flame, and strike!" In desperate obedience, Will filled his whole mind with the picture of the great circle of tall, tall candle flames behind him, growing like a white tree. And as he did so, he felt the minds of his two supporters doing the same, knew that the three of them together could accomplish more than he ever imagined. He felt a quick pressure in each hand from the hand holding it, and he struck forward in his mind with the column of light, lashing it out as if it were a giant whip. Over his head there came a vast, crashing flash of white light, as the tall flames reared forward and down in a bolt of lightning, and a tremendous shriek from the darkness beyond as something, the rider, the black stallion, both, fell away, out, down, endlessly down. And in the gap cleft in the darkness, there before them, while he still blinked dazzled eyes, stood the two great carved wooden doors through which he had first come into the hall. In the sudden silence, Will heard himself shout triumphantly, and he leapt forward, tugging free of the hands that held his own, to run to the doors. Both Merriman and the old lady cried out in warning, but it was too late. Will had broken the circle. He was standing alone. No sooner did he realize it than he felt giddy and staggered, clutching his head, a strange ringing sound beginning to thrum in his ears. Forcing his legs to move, he lurched to the doors, leaned against them, and beat feebly on them with his fists. They did not move. The eerie ringing in his head grew. He saw Merriman moving up before him, walking with great effort, leaning far forward as though he were straining against a high wind. "Foolish," Merriman gasped. "Foolish, Will." He seized the doors and shook them, thrusting forward with the strength of both his arms so that the twisted veins beside his brows stood up from the skin like thick wire. And as he did so, he lifted his head and shouted a long commanding phrase that Will did not understand. But the doors did not move, and Will felt weakness drawing him down, as if he were a snowman melting in the sun. The thing that brought him back to wakefulness, just as he was beginning to drift into a kind of trance, was something he was never able to describe, or even to remember very well. It was like the ending of pain, like discord changing to harmony, like the lightening of the spirits that you may feel suddenly in the middle of a grey, dull day, unaccountable until you realize that the sun has begun to shine. This silent music that entered Will's mind and took hold of his spirit came, he knew instantly, from the old lady. Without speech, she was speaking to him. She was speaking to both of them, and to the dark. He looked back, dazzled. She seemed taller, bigger, more erect than before, a figure on an altogether larger scale. And there was a golden haze about her figure, a glow that did not come from the candlelight. Will blinked, but he could not see clearly. It was as if he was separated from her by a veil. He heard Merriman's deep voice, gentler than he had yet heard it, but wrung with some strong, sudden unhappiness. "Madam," Merriman said wretchedly, "take care. Take care." No voice replied, but Will had a feeling of benison. Then it was gone, and the tall, glowing form that was and yet was not the old lady moved slowly forward in the darkness towards the doors. And for an instant Will heard again the haunting phrase of music that he could never capture in his memory, and the doors slowly opened. Outside there was a grey light and silence, and the air was cold. Behind him, the light of the candle ring was gone, and there was only darkness. It was an uneasy, empty darkness, so that he knew the hall was no longer there. And suddenly he realized that the luminous golden figure before him was fading too, vanishing away like smoke that grows thinner, thinner, until it cannot be seen at all. For an instant there was a flash of rose-colored brilliance from the huge ring that had been on the old lady's hand, and then that too dimmed, and her bright presence faded into nothing. Will felt a desperate ache of loss, as if his whole world had been swallowed up by the dark, and he cried out. A hand touched his shoulder. Merriman was at his side. They were through the doors. Slowly the great wooden carved portals swung back behind them, long enough for Will to see clearly that they were indeed the same strange gates that had opened for him before on the white, untrodden slope of a Chiltern hill. Then, at the moment that they closed, the doors too were no longer there. He saw nothing, only the grey light of snow that reflects a grey sky. He was back in the snow-drowned woodland world into which he had walked early that morning. Anxiously he swung round to Merriman. "Where is she? What happened?"
"It was too much for her. The strain was too great, even for her. Never before. I have never seen this before."
His voice was thick and bitter. He stared angrily at nothing.
"Have they taken her?"
Will did not know what words to use for the fear.
"No,"
Merriman said. The word was so quick with scorn, it might have been a laugh.
"The lady is beyond their power. Beyond any power. You will not ask a question like that when you have learned a little. She's gone away for a time, that is all. It was the opening of the doors in the face of all that was willing them shut. Though the dark could not destroy her, it has drained her. Left her like a shell. She must recover herself away, alone, and that is bad for us, if we should need her. As we shall. As the world always will."
He glanced down at Will without warmth. Suddenly he seemed distant, almost threatening, like an enemy. He waved one hand impatiently.
"Close your coat, boy, before you freeze."
Will fumbled with the buttons of his heavy jacket. Merriman, he saw, was wrapped in a long, battered blue cloak, high-collared.
"It was my fault, wasn't it?" he said miserably. "If I hadn't run forward, when I saw the doors, if I'd kept hold of your hands and not broken the circle..."
Merriman said curtly,
"Yes."
Then he relented a little.
"But it was their doing, Will, not yours. They seized you through your impatience and your hope. They love to twist good emotion to accomplish ill."
Will stood hunched with his hands in his pockets, staring at the ground. Behind his mind, a chant went sneering through his head. "You have lost the lady, you have lost the lady." Unhappiness was thick in his throat. He swallowed. He could not speak. A breeze blew through the trees and sprayed snow crystals into his face.
"Well," Merriman said, "I was angry. Forgive me. Whether you had broken the three or not, things would have been the same. The doors are our great gateway into time, and you will know more about the uses of them before long. But this time you could not have opened them, nor I, nor perhaps any of the circle.
for the force that was pushing against them was the full midwinter power of the dark, which none but the lady can overcome alone, and even she only at great cost. Take heart. At the proper time, she will return. He pulled at the high collar of his cloak, and it became a hood that he drew over his head. With the white hair hidden, he was a dark figure, suddenly tall and inscrutable. "Come," he said, and led Will through the deep snow among great beeches and oaks, bare of leaves. At length they paused in a clearing. "You know where you are," Merriman said. Will stared round at the smooth snowbanks, the rearing trees.
"Of course I don't," he said. "How could I?"
"Yet before the winter is three-quarters done," Merriman said, "you will be creeping into this dell to look at the snowdrops that grow everywhere between the trees. And then in the spring you will be back to stare at the daffodils. Every day for a week, to judge from last year."
Will gaped at him.
"You mean the manor," he said. "The manor grounds."
In his own century, Huntercombe Manor was the great house of the village. The house itself could not be seen from the road, but its grounds lay along the side of Huntercombe Lane opposite the Stantons' house, and stretched a long way in each direction, edged alternately by tall wrought-iron railings and ancient brick walls. A Miss Greythorne owned it, as her family had for centuries, but Will did not know her well. He seldom saw her or her manor, which he remembered vaguely as a mass of tall brick gables and Tudor chimneys. The flowers that Merriman had spoken of were private landmarks in his year. For as long as he could remember, he had slipped through the manor railings at the end of winter to stand in this one magical clearing and gaze at the gentle winter-banishing snowdrops, and later the golden daffodil glow of spring. He did not know who had planted the flowers. He had never seen anyone visiting them. He was not even sure whether anyone else knew they were there. The image of them glowed now in his mind. But rearing questions very soon chased it out.
"Merriman, do you mean this clearing is here hundreds of years before I first saw it? And the Great Hall, is it a manor before the manor, out of centuries ago? And the forest all round us, that I came through when I saw the smith and the rider. It stretches everywhere. Does it all belong to—"
Merriman looked down at him and laughed, a gay laugh, suddenly without the heaviness that had been over them both.
"Let me show you something else," he said.
And he drew Will further through the trees, away from the clearing, until there was an end to the sequence of trunks and mounds of snow. And before him, Will saw not the morning's narrow track that he had been expecting, winding its way through an endless forest of ancient crowding trees, but the familiar 20th-century line of Huntercombe Lane, and beyond it, a little way up the road, a glimpse of his own house. The manor railings were before them, somewhat shortened by the deep snow. Merriman stepped stiff-legged over. Will crept through his usual gap, and they were standing on the snow-banked road. Merriman put back his hood again and lifted his white-maned head as if to sniff the air of this newer century.
"You see, Will," he said, "we of the circle are planted only loosely within time. The doors are a way through it in any direction we may choose. For all times coexist, and the future can sometimes affect the past, even though the past is a road that leads to the future. But men cannot understand this. Nor will you for a while yet. We can travel through the years in other ways, too. One of them was used this morning to bring you back through 5 centuries or so. That is where you were. In the time of the Royal Forest that stretched over all the southern part of this land from Southampton Water up to the valley of the Thames here."
He pointed across the road to the flat horizon, and Will remembered how he had seen the Thames 2 times that morning, once among its familiar fields, once buried instead among trees. He stared at the intensity of remembering on Merriman's face.
500 years ago," Merriman said, "the kings of England chose deliberately to preserve those forests, swallowing up whole villages and hamlets inside them.
so that the wild things, the deer and the boars and even the wolves, might breed there for the hunt. But forests are not biddable places, and the kings were, without knowing it, establishing a haven too for the powers of the dark, which might otherwise have been driven back then to the mountains